Quite a few people asked me questions just now. We'll have some questions later. But there's some things I'd like to say before we get there. And, so my idea was a bit of a talk and discussion, and then a break, another break, and then we finish with a meditation and a puja, if we've got time for that. So, one of the great things about this kind of practice is that you get a sense that you're practicing in some way with all beings. There's a sort of sense that you're practicing in relationship to all beings, and I think this is a very, very it's a very positive thing. And you can almost meditate for the sake of others as well as for yourself. It sort of spreads out the motive for practice. And I think the kind of more ethical aspect of meditation practice is very important for us. I think we care about our actions, we care about our shila, or our morality, if you like. I think we might be very interested in insight, you know, to bring meaning into our life, and to bring meaning to our practice even more. But I think more fundamental, actually, to most of us is the social dimension of things. I mean, those things don't cancel each other out. But I think uppermost in a lot of people's minds is the social dimension, like how we live, how we actually live. That's really important. And it's important to us what we become. What's going to become of us? It's important to us how society is. You know, this is quite a big thing at the moment, I think. It's like, where's it all going? You know? I think society is in many ways in quite a difficult place, generally. We don't have time to talk about that. But if we were going to choose one aspect of all the kind of current world problems that there are, I would home in on the issue of individualism. And I think in the world of Buddhism, the world of Dharma practice, you can observe that it's become more and more somehow disconnected and individualized. It's more and more for the individual person. It's less and less a group thing or a collective thing. I think Tree Ratan is a bit different, but it affects us as well. I mean, there's so much good stuff available online in the city, not just online, but like all over the place. There's so much good material available. And, you know, I might do my Saturday morning class at West London Centre, and people come along. They might already have looked up the material I'm going to talk about on Wikipedia or something like that, and they will get good information as well. They'll get good information. And you can listen to really very good talks by excellent Dharma teachers on the internet. You can have personal contact with them as well. It's like there's so much available out there, as it were, and a lot of it is very good. And we're getting in a position where we can, in a way, we can create our own very particular, specialised form of practice and find, like, 10 or 12 other people who are interested in exactly the same thing and just connect with that. And we can... We can do Buddhism exactly how we like, in the privacy of our own home, as it were. More and more, and I think that more and more people do that kind of thing, and it sort of gets to the point where you wonder what's so great about having a Buddhist movement in the first place. what's the great advantage of having a Buddhist movement like we have? And I think, to raise the question, I think it's a good question to raise, why do we do this? I think it's because it builds a tradition that has integrity, has a certain integrity to it. There's a certain continuity to it that's created by the connections we make with one another. And it's a worldwide thing as well, but it's also local. And there's a particular spirit that comes out of that continuity, out of that tradition, that you'll find in other similar places. The spirit of Triratna, as it were, is quite recognisable. I can't explain it, but it's quite recognisable. So I think what a movement is and what it does is something that creates a collective value which we contribute to and also which we get something from. I think if Buddhism becomes, as in some quarters it is becoming, a lot of individual and separate teachers just following their own interests, with students also following their own interest and just moving as they like between different teachers and remaining disconnected from one another, I think that's not really going to help that much. And it's not going to create collective ideals. So to me it seems that having a movement and working cooperatively to create communities of various kinds, not necessarily ones that you live in, but not excluding those, communities within a movement like that, it's much more difficult to do it, actually. It's quite a difficult thing to do, but it's far more beneficial. You get more from it. And this, what happens when you do decide to work together with others to co-create some kind of culture, some kind of Dharma culture, that's what you get. You get the culture, as it were. And it's a culture that's based on the practices we're doing today. It's based on love and wisdom. Those qualities of love, compassion, appreciative joy and wisdom. I think I mentioned this morning that, well, I definitely did mention this morning, that metta and compassion are part of this spectrum of practices, the four aparimanas, or the four brahmaviharas. And these are part of the second part of the Buddha's Eightfold Path. It's called Samyak Sankalpo, or Right Resolve. It's the part of the Buddha's path where it's about where your energies are going. It's like the part of the path where you're getting you to face in the right direction, as it were, to move yourself in the right direction. And I think we can be directed by these Brahmavihara practices. They offer, in a way, they offer a way to strengthen our discipline as much as anything else. They offer us a way to get us moving in particular ways, if you like. Obviously, this word discipline is a bit of a problem word, but it does actually it can motivate us to get up in the morning, that kind of thing. The motive that we would wish for others, including ourselves, to let go our clinging to what causes suffering, this is a profound motive. It's a profound wish that we kind of weave into the way we are. And this compassion and this kind of practice relates to what's called the accumulation of merit as opposed to wisdom. You have these two aspects of the path, merit and wisdom. And merit just means our good qualities, our merits, if you like. I think we may often, people often resist the idea that they have good qualities. It's a common symptom of depression that we feel we don't have anything. We don't have any good qualities. We compare ourselves with others and we feel that we're just rubbish compared with them. And it can be quite extreme. And maybe some of us have felt that degree of isolation from our own positive qualities. Which is very tough, you know. But I think we need to understand the value of merit, the value of our good qualities. It's important in relation to wisdom. Okay, so a little bit about the other thing, wisdom. Talk about merit, talk about wisdom. Wisdom is seeing things as they are, seeing things as they actually are. And the value of wisdom is that it cuts through wrong views. And cutting through our wrong views about who we are, our wrong views about the nature of existence, this has the benefit of cutting through negative attitudes. It has the benefit also of cutting through habits of greed, hatred, and delusion, to put it like that. We become less greedy because we see that greed is a form of suffering. We actually see that. That is wisdom. We see that this behaviour I get into, this irritation, this anger I get into, is not justified. It's suffering. When we see that our negative mental states are suffering, actually, it's not so hard to drop them. And that is wisdom cutting through the ego identification with a particular negative tendency. That's how wisdom works. But so that's the wisdom side. On the side of compassion, compassion cuts through these negative states as well, and it does almost as effective a job, because the quality of compassion is the same as the quality of craving when it's let go of. When you let go of craving, you have this freed up quality of that is wise and is positive. So what the difference between wisdom and compassion, they both have the same end, but one of them already has the right flavour. You've got the flavour of compassion comes through by developing it. The flavour of compassion comes through wisdom by exercising wisdom. See what I mean? So developing the Brahma Viharas, you're developing the qualities that wisdom gets you to. So it's already developing the quality that comes about indirectly through wisdom. So there's a whole way of practice using the Brahma Viharas as gateways to insight and of dropping off of these, they're called klesha, these negative tendencies or these unskillful tendencies to greed, hatred or delusion. This method of radiation, radiating the quality, has some, I think we've already been talking about it a bit, has a little bit of this quality of cutting through our idea of who we are. I think we talked about it a little bit earlier. You know, you radiate the quality out to infinite space, and you start to wonder, well, where am I in all this? Where am I in all this? Well, you weren't anywhere right from the start. It's like where you are is a bit of a strange question. Where are you now? Or maybe I'm somewhere inside my body, for example. This is an idea, a story that we tell ourselves. That the we, the me, is here, whereas it's not really something we can pin down. So the radiating out plays, if you like, plays with this issue of no need to identify so strongly with a centre. In a way, I'm recapitulating much of what I said this morning. But there's one... this is what I'm trying to get to. There's one connection I haven't made, which is the connection with jhana. I think most of you will have know what jhana is. Jhana is the states of deeper concentration that come about through practices like the mindfulness of breathing practice. Any practice where the mind is concentrated or resting in a single object. And in resting the mind on a single object, over a period of time, that resting becomes free of conflict. You don't have any conflict about it. You just go more deeply into it. And the hindrances to practice disperse. The mind becomes even more bright and present. And you start to really enjoy the practice. It becomes blissful. It becomes blissful, and there's a kind of deep happiness that comes out of these concentration practice. And this is known as jhana, sort of deeper concentration. I just wanted to make the contrast between this kind of absorbed state where you're focusing in on a single object and the absorbed state that you get from focusing outwards on absolutely everything, on infinity, if you like. Which is a kind of absorbed state. It's just almost going in the other direction. What's called Brahmavihara Tharana, or radiation, is described like this. He or she dwells pervading one direction with a mind imbued with compassion. Likewise the second direction, likewise the third direction, likewise the fourth. So above, below, transversely, everywhere and in every respect. I think this comes from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. He dwells or she dwells pervading the entire world with a mind imbued with karuna. Imbued with compassion, abundant, extensive, boundless, devoid of hostility, devoid of ill will. So you have this sense of complete lack of boundary. Sometimes we talk about such and such a person hasn't got any boundaries. Such and such a person should have some boundaries. You know, boundaries are necessary, right? So, but this practice, the boundaries are completely removed. But there's another kind of absorption, which is called the arupa dhatu, or the formless realms, or the formless bases. And these are sometimes connected with the jhanas, but actually they're quite independent of the jhanas. And they are also states of absorption, which are slightly separated from the Brahmaviharas, but they seem to be very similar. And they're states of absorption where you, having reached a degree of concentration, you open up to the boundlessness of space. This is the first formless jhana, is infinite space. You just sit there and you say, wow, space is infinite. Space is infinite. And anyway, you just allow yourself to experience the infinity of space. It's very similar, isn't it, to that Brahmavihara radiation, the infinity of space. The second degree, or the second level of the arupa loka, or the arupa dhatu, the basis that is formless, is infinite awareness or infinite consciousness. So having let go, as it were, into infinite space, you think, oh my goodness, consciousness, awareness, my awareness is also infinite. Not just my awareness, but just awareness is infinite. There's no end to it. You know, if there is this experience of infinite space, there is also an experience of infinite consciousness. So it's not about this idea of space, it's also about this idea of awareness is somehow, in some way, infinite. And it's a state of deep, profound absorption, the kind of absorption that will keep you absorbed for hours at a time, possibly. It's quite a strong experience, it can be. The third level of this, and these are obviously connected with insight in some way, the third arupa jhana or arupa dhatu level is the realm of no thing, the realm of no thingness, sometimes it's called. I think that's a literal translation actually of the Pali. And you realize that in this space, in the entire space of awareness, even though there are things like iPads and microphones and glasses and bells and things like that, there are things. But if you really look at those things, they are simply comings together of particular conditions, to the extent that those things are not, they are so not fixed as those things. They're completely unfixed. In a sense, there are no things. It's like it's an experience what's the word? Universality. It's a all these four actually, the infinite space, the infinite consciousness, they are experiences which can't really be explained by these little labels like infinite consciousness. They are states of a universal realization of how things are universally. And this is a realization of the universal nature of things, that there are no concrete fixed things. It's obviously some kind of insight experience. But it can come from simply spreading out our awareness in this way. So something about that quality of spreading out invokes the realization that of no-thingness. And it's an absorption. And then the fourth, and the last of these four, is called the realm of neither perception nor non-perception. So, okay, I am perceiving things, all right? I am perceiving that there are no things, really. But in a way, the perceptions that I'm having are not really mine to have. I can't really say they are mine. They're just arising. In fact, we can always say this about our perception. We say, well, who's having this experience? Well, I don't know. Who's having the experience? Well, I am, but actually we don't know what the I bit is really referring to. It's too profound to really understand. So we have this shorthand way of speaking, this is me, this is you. We don't really understand what's happening. The fourth of these very subtle but also very profound states is the state of neither perception nor non-perception. You can't say it's perceived, you can't say it's not perceived. So I don't know if this is helpful, any of this, but I'm just kind of tying in with these states that are described in the Buddhist literature around very deep states of meditation. And these are also jhanas, or their states of absorption. So you have the ordinary four jhanas, which I'm not even going to go into. You've got the arupa jhanas, these four that I've just been trying to explain. And you've got the radiation of the four Brahma Viharas. So I don't know if that's helpful, but at least it's interesting, yeah. And I don't know if this is going to be useful either, but there's apparently each of the Brahma Viharas culminates in a particular point, and the culmination of the radiation of metta, it culminates in a state of beauty. It's called the beautiful. It's a state of mental beauty, you could say. It's a state where the mind is experienced, or the experience is, of profound beauty. It's beautiful. What I've written here down as a descriptor of that is the way the inner attitude of metta, and metta being non-reactive kindness, it's the way that displays itself in deeds and also in bodily demeanour and appearance. So you experience yourself as beautiful. You also experience the world as beautiful. So that's the culmination of the radiation of metta, according to tradition. According to tradition, the culmination of the radiation of karuna is the realm of infinite space. So I make the connection here with the arupas. The culmination of that radiation of karuna is a profound experience of infinite space. And you can kind of get into that from what we were doing this morning a little bit. You can get that a bit. The culmination of the radiation of mudita, this empathetic joy, appreciative joy, is the sphere of infinite consciousness. We probably need to do the practice to get any understanding of that, but this is what the tradition says. And then the culmination of the radiation of upeksha, or equanimity, which we haven't even started to get into, may not have time for, is the realm of no-thingness. I can get a bit of a sense of what that means, but I'm not going to try and explain it, because I'd rather we did it from a perspective of some experience. So we need a longer retreat. We need a retreat, basically. But maybe you get the sense that this is all a bit connected up in Buddhist tradition. At least you get that. And in the work I'm trying to do, I'm trying to make these connections, because I think metta and the Brahma Viharas is still a bit unexplored, especially in relation to insight and other practices. It's got its own... We tend to teach it in its own little realm, but actually it's all connected in with the rest of Buddhist tradition. I find that interesting as well as important as well. And I just say again, like these experiences of boundlessness, they stretch the self-sense to the point where it almost has no meaning anymore. It doesn't matter anymore, put it like that. And I think that's a good thing, because I think it helps us release our clinging to a fixed identity. And also because they're about boundless compassion for all beings whatsoever, they already have the quality of letting go self. There's the connection with wisdom. And all this needs to be grounded in our present moment experience. And even though you extend out to the point where you don't know who you are anymore, at the same time, it needs to be grounded in present experience. So you don't... There's a certain kind of ground that you don't lose. So even though you might lose yourself in giving to others, as it were, you might completely lose yourself. At the same time, you stay with your actual experience. The experience is actually the one that you are having. And that's your ground, that's your anchor in reality, you know, not feeling that you're kind of losing your mind in the wrong sense, okay? But you might be losing your unskillful attitudes and habits, but you are staying with your present experience. So that's actually very encouraging, and which should be very encouraging and centering and grounding. So I'm afraid that's all I have to say. I've got this little phrase: there is within all of us something of the nature of the boundlessness of the stars, the sun, and the moon. And I hope that ties together, which is rather an incoherent talk. But never mind.
Thank you very much.